Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dan Beaton of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the conduct and legitimacy of the contested November 24th Honduran presidential election. A report on the recent direct action protest in Connecticut targeting Swiss banking giant UBS for their role in financing mountaintop removal coal mining in Appalachia. And Todd Gitlin, professor of journalism, activist, and author, who explains why he believes the divestment campaign targeting the fossil fuel industry could be key in advancing the movement confronting climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
France has committed to increasing the size of its military presence in the Central African Republic to at least 1,000 soldiers to combat rising religious violence that has forced over 400,000 people to flee their homes. The Central African Republic has been in turmoil since a March coup by longtime rebel leader Michel Djotodia of the Seleka Coalition of Muslim Fighters, which have led recent attacks against mostly Christian villages. In response, new Christian militias have been organized to defend against Seleka assaults, displacing tens of thousands of people in the small nation of 4.6 million people. The French pledge to send more troops into the resource-rich Central African Republic comes less than a year after the French military intervened in Mali, another former French colony, in a campaign to stop Islamist guerrilla groups from taking over the West African country. Reuters has reported that a French-drafted United Nations resolution would provide a six-month mandate for French troops and the African-led International Support Mission, or MISCA, to restore order, protect civilians, and rebuild state authority. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said in November that he had ordered officials to start preparing for the likely deployment of a mission of 6,000 UN peacekeepers and 1,700 police. A Dutch children's rights group, Terre des Hommes, has identified over 1,000 potential sexual predators from 71 countries using a digital decoy, a computer-generated image of a 10-year-old Filipino girl named Sweetie. The rights group is now advocating a global campaign to enlist law enforcement agencies to use similar techniques to crack down on online sex tourism. The rights group conducted its sting from Amsterdam. In a video, investigators for Terre des Hommes described the 10-week campaign to track online sexual predators from the thousands of messages that were sent once Sweetie entered an online chat room. Individual respondents offered money to the decoy to pose naked and/or perform sexual acts. Researchers later tracked down the chat room participants via Google and Facebook. However, the group only identified a fraction of the 20,000 internet users who approached Sweetie, mostly from wealthier nations. Terre des Hommes estimates that 750,000 pedophiles lurk online at any given moment and that their number is on the rise, but only 6 men have ever been charged with a crime. According to the Christian Science Monitor, there is currently no international law enforcement body to stop online sexual predators or to protect the rights of minors. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, formerly Barack Obama's White House Chief of Staff and an investment banker, was confronted by protests at his city's 175th anniversary celebration in March 2012. A banner in the crowd read, "History will judge Mayor 1% Emanuel for closing mental health clinics." Then activist Helen Morley yelled out to Mayor Emanuel, "Please don't close our clinics. We are going to die. There is nowhere else to go." Morley has struggled with mental health problems for much of her life and became a leading foe of budget cuts to local mental health treatment advocated by Mayor Emanuel. In response to Emanuel's policies cutting city services, including the closure of 50 public schools, mostly in Black and Latino neighborhoods, Chicago's progressive community activists have launched a series of dynamic grassroots campaigns, including last September's successful Chicago teachers' strike. In mid-October, 1,500 community activists rallied to take back Chicago from Mayor Emanuel and his corporate allies. The grassroots coalition called for fair tax formulas, refunding public education, and affordable housing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Juan Orlando Hernandez of the conservative ruling National Party was declared the winner of the presidential election held in Honduras on November 24th. But the runner-up in the contest, left-wing candidate Xiomara Castro, has charged the election was stolen by fraud and demanded a recount. Castro is the wife of former Honduran President Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted in a coup backed by the military and Hernandez in 2009. According to the Honduran Electoral Court, Hernandez won 37% of the vote, while Castro won 29%. Castro's Libre Party, formed by grassroots activists resisting the 2009 coup, have suffered repression at the hands of police in recent years. During the weekend of the election, three Libre Party activists were murdered. At a Libre Party rally denouncing election fraud in the Honduran capital of Tegucigalpa on November 30th, Castro and Zelaya led the protest march in a pickup truck carrying the body of a fallen Libre Party member who had been shot to death hours before the demonstration began. Honduran party officials and international delegations observing the election reported witnessing cases of fraud, vote buying, and the intimidation and bribery of poll workers. The Libre Party further charged that there were inexplicable discrepancies between polling station tally sheets and the official results posted by the nation's Supreme Electoral Tribunal. Under growing pressure from protests, Honduran electoral authorities agreed on December 2nd to review vote tallies from last week's presidential election. Your reporter spoke with Dan Beaton, International Communications Director with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses the conduct and legitimacy of the contested November 24th Honduran presidential election.
First of all, I was live blogging it all day, and I was getting reports from on the ground, people who were throughout Honduras, mostly North Americans, telling me what they were seeing in real time, and then I'd post that on the blog as well as I was monitoring media and social media, including the Twitter accounts of the candidates, things like that, just trying to keep up in real time as much as I could with what was going on. And what I was hearing was really disturbing. There were a number of incidents of violence and intimidation, both the day before the elections and then throughout Election Day itself. A lot of cases of intimidation against the Libre Party of Xiomara Castro de Zelaya, and especially, and just a lot of irregularities that people were seeing, and in some cases documenting with photos and video, which we link to on the blog. So it was not a clean election, and I think it's very important for your listeners to know that it was an election that took place in the context of very disturbing violence, including the killings of 20 members of the Libre Party in the current election cycle, which is from May last year up through Election Day.
What specific evidence that Xiomara Castro, her husband, and the Libre Party have that this election was stolen? What have they presented thus far to sort of justify their contention that massive fraud had been committed?
Well, what they're saying is that there's a big number of tallies from the voting centers that do not match up with the official results being reported by the electoral authority. So you had 5,000 voting centers throughout the country, and within those are mesas or tables where people would actually vote. And each of those tables is supposed to report a tally sheet. And the electoral authority, they're actually posting what they say were the transmitted digitized versions of the tally sheets online, the results of those. But when compared with the actual tally sheets people had seen, there are a number of cases where they didn't match up. So that's what they're talking about. To add to the concern, as I mentioned before, there were numerous irregularities reported on Election Day. And I have to point out, because I think it's very hard for people to understand this from the U.S. media accounts of the election. You had the European Union and the Organization of American States down there, the most prestigious of the electoral observation delegations. And as well as you had other delegations, including the National Lawyers Guild, you had a delegation of trade unions, which included members of the AFL-CIO and the largest trade union confederation in Brazil. You had the Honduras Solidarity Network, which, you know, is more of a grassroots kind of electoral observation group that had almost 170 people from the United States and Canada down there. And all these delegations were reporting some of the same things. And one of them was that there was credential buying going on. How this relates to the tallies is that each political party, of which there were nine, is supposed to have a representative in each voting center. And what most often these delegations, these observers, were saying is that the national party was buying the credentials of some of the smaller parties in these voting centers. So you could conceivably have situations where you have some voting centers where the national party, instead of having their one representative, might have four or five or something like that. And then sometimes the Libre representative, the Amara Castro's party, might not be in there because they were kept out. They were intimidated, or they were intimidated into turning over their tally sheet. These are all things that were reported. You know, these are all things that people witnessed. And so that's a very disturbing situation, and that's why there's so much concern that this be taken seriously and be reviewed by the electoral authorities.
What are the prospects, Dan, that the officials overseeing the election will do a vote-by-vote recount as demanded by Xiomara Castro and her husband Manuel Zelaya and the Libre Party?
Well, that's really the question. The latest news today is that the electoral authorities are saying they will review the tally sheets, which is, you know, the first thing that, in my opinion, certainly needs to happen to try to get a sense of if a vote-by-vote recount is warranted. But, you know, even with the tally sheets, it's unclear what that means. Are they going to review all of them, and are they going to review them, you know, versus the discrepancies that the Libre Party is claiming? But unfortunately, what we've been seeing is that there have been mistakes reported on the Electoral Authority's website, and they've been quietly correcting some of those without, you know, telling anybody. So it's entirely possible that they might correct some of the errors, but not really deal with all the discrepancies that Libre is talking about.
That was Dan Beaton, International Communications Director with the Center for Economic and Policy Research based in Washington, D.C. Find links to analysis and commentary on the Honduran presidential election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. An activist group from the Southern Coalfields calling itself Hands Off Appalachia and a Connecticut-based group named Capitalism Versus the Climate carried out two protest actions in Stamford, Connecticut on November 25th, targeting the U.S. headquarters of Swiss banking giant UBS. The groups say the bank was targeted because it is a major financer of mountaintop removal coal mining. Mountaintop removal coal mining is a mineral extraction method in which the tops of mountain ridges are literally blown off with explosives in order to mine the coal seams beneath. The earth and rock rubble is dumped into the valleys below, and thus far more than 2,000 miles of streams have been buried through this process. The mining method has also been linked to increased rates of cancer, birth defects, and cardiovascular disease. In the early morning hours of November 25th, four activists scaled a construction crane outside the bank and hung a large banner which read, UBS, Stop Funding Mountaintop Removal. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus later accompanied a small group of protesters inside UBS corporate headquarters, where two activists chained themselves to a railing over which they hung a second banner. In all, 14 protesters were arrested and charged with first and second degree criminal trespass, second degree breach of peace, and conspiracy. The activists were later released on bail and are to appear in court in January. In Melinda Tuhus's report on the protest, we hear first from Hands Off Appalachia member Ricky Draper of Knoxville, Tennessee.
We just dropped a banner that says UBS stop funding mountaintop removal, and we are here and we are going to stay locked in by our necks with ULOX, and we're here to demand that UBS stop funding mountaintop removal because it's killing communities in Appalachia?
I'm Dustin Still. I'm originally from Mingo County, West Virginia. UBS funds companies like Arch, who is presently trying to destroy Blair Mountain, and also Patriot, who has just succeeded in stealing working people's pensions and health benefits. So we're here at least for one day to hold them accountable for the really damaging practices that they fund. And they're the silent partner. They're the people that get no pressure, but without the money UBS facilitates, mountaintop removal would not be possible. And we got to make sure that banks like UBS know that people of Appalachia won't stand for this.
On the sidewalk outside UBS headquarters, Hands Off Appalachia spokesperson Tyler Cannon further explained what's at stake and why his group targeted UBS.
We've taken action here today to demand that UBS withdraws all contributions to organizations that support or practice mountaintop removal. For over 2 years, this campaign has worked to meet with UBS, a UBS executive, and we finally achieved that last week. Unfortunately, they gave us the same response they've continuously given us, which is to continue to refer to their inadequate policies surrounding mountaintop removal. In communities around mountaintop removal mines, like the one I was raised in, there are increased rates of heart disease, respiratory disease, developmental disease, over 50% greater likelihood of having a deadly cancer, and the life expectancy is 24 years below the national average. And if that doesn't qualify as a human rights violation, then I'm not really sure what does. And so we're here to demand that this is stopped.
So they're up there, and they are locked in so tightly with those U-locks, I can't even imagine how they're going to get them out of there without really hurting them. So do you think that taking that kind of action, which seems fairly extreme, is really justified?
These actions are what people call extreme and radical. But what is extreme and radical is detonating up to 1,100 feet of a mountain and then filling the valley below with the remnants, which they deem overburden. They commodify the earth and destroy it. And they destroy the air, the water, the people, and any hope for prosperity for these communities. And the idea that an extractive industry, an extractive culture can be made into one that is sustainable is foolish. Clean coal is a lie. So we've been driven to these lengths. The validity of our demands has not been acknowledged by neither the state nor corporate giants like UBS or Alpha or Peabody or Patriot. UBS funds these industries through a really twisted corporate buffer. And if you research into this corporate buffer further through stock holdings and the like, then you'll see the intersectionality between all extractive industries. For example, one of the top shareholders in UBS is Vanguard. Vanguard is also the number two shareholder in ExxonMobil. So if you're telling me that what's happening here is extreme, I think what's happening in the economy is extreme. What's happening to poor people in rural areas, in urban areas, I think that is extreme.
So unfortunately, a lot of people didn't see what happened here. You're coming from the coal fields. What's the message that you want to give, you know, to people in Connecticut who probably, you know, most of them, I'm sure, have never heard of mountaintop removal?
There is no desegregation of civil liberties on behalf of the people who are having them taken away alone. It needs to be an act of solidarity from the privileged to the underprivileged. We need people all across the nation, not just in Connecticut, from coast to coast, to stand for clean air and clean water and a space for a clean life.
This report on the November 25th Stamford, Connecticut protest against Swiss banking giant UBS for their role in financing mountaintop removal coal mining was produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. For more information on opposition to mountaintop removal coal mining and the groups that organized this direct action, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the winter of 2012, Bill McKibben, the author of a dozen books about the environment and founder of the grassroots climate change campaign group 350.org, launched a 21-city tour focused on organizing university students and faculty to pressure their institutions to divest their portfolios of fossil fuel stocks and other investments. McKibben was inspired by the international anti-apartheid divestment campaign of the 1980s that was an important part of the movement that helped topple South Africa's racist government. In the year since McKibben's tour, at least 8 colleges and universities have voted to divest: San Francisco State University, Foothill De Anza Community College in Los Altos Hills, California, Unity College and College of the Atlantic, both in Maine, Hampshire College in Massachusetts, and Sterling College and Green Mountain College, both in Vermont. Meanwhile, organizing is moving forward on other campuses and in some cities, independent pension funds and religious groups to begin the process of divestment. However, at well-known universities such as Harvard, Brown, and Cornell, administrators have rejected their students' demand to divest. Your reporter spoke with Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University and activist and author of 15 books. Gitlin, a former president of the activist group Students for a Democratic Society and veteran Vietnam War protest organizer, assesses the importance of the fossil fuel divestment campaign, as discussed in his recent article, How to Reverse a Slow-Motion Apocalypse, Why the Divestment Movement Against Big Energy Matters.
Well, I think what's happened over the last 5 years or so is a recognition on the part of people who recognize that climate change is taking place and that it's potentially catastrophic, a kind of recognition that they have failed to deliver the necessary change by appealing to the government to pass the right regulations, because the obstacles are, at least have been, insuperable. The lobbying, the disinformation, the campaign financing, and so on by the fossil fuel companies has thrown up a brick wall. So if the government under present conditions is frozen, then where do you look for leverage? And you look for leverage someplace where you can actually imagine a change that cascades into larger changes. And that's, I think, the sort of the rubric under which the most interesting elements of the climate change movement are operating. One of them has to do with calling public attention to and trying to obstruct the development of fossil fuel intensive developments like the shipping of the tar sands from Alberta to the southern U.S. For shipment to China. You know, there are various movements to stop the Keystone Pipeline and other sorts of pipelines, I think, are very much apropos. In other words, acts of civil disobedience and popular campaigns to get political support for at least not worsening the current climate situation. The second development that's kind of mushroomed in the last year is the attempt to get public boards or private boards, could be cities, could be public pension funds, and I think most widespread university investors to divest from fossil fuel corporations. Not because there's some naive belief that nobody will buy the shares that they sell, but rather because the idea is to underscore in the public mind that these corporations have a business model which is contrary to human survival. Their business depends on excavating more and more fossil fuels out of the air and dumping more and more carbon into the atmosphere, which is a road to doomsday. So the idea of trying to get a university to divest from these companies is not built on any delusion about the dollar value here. It's built on the belief that at a time when most people doubt that business and government are actually capable of doing the right thing, that here might be another institution which can shine a light on unsavory practices and sort of declare with drama and, you know, with crashing cymbals that there's something that can actually be done to further the good and to retard the bad. That is to label these companies as destructive and to suggest that they need to be shown, they need to be understood the way we understand tobacco companies, namely as institutions that have a stake in public disease.
I've read that thus far, 8 small colleges and nearly 24 towns and cities have pledged to sell their shares in fossil fuel companies. But you point out in your article that the economic impact can really exponentially grow if pension funds and state-issued bonds would be part of the picture in terms of divestment. You see the groundwork being laid down now for that eventuality? You think that can
happen? Yeah, I do. This movement has moved with great velocity, and so the it's true. Only a few small liberal arts colleges have divested so far, but a number of cities have declared their intention to do so. A number of large investment pools, pension fund pools in California and elsewhere, have said that they're looking askance at these investments. There are now my alma mater, Harvard, has a very active student campaign and with an alumni wing and so on that is urging people, alumni and faculty and others, not to donate to Harvard's official campaign, but to invest instead in an escrow fund that won't be released until there is divestment from the top 200 fossil fuel corporations. And the thing is catching on. I mean, there are more and more people talking about it. But it's not a sure thing. I don't think anything's a sure thing. But I do think there is a momentum here.
That was Todd Gitlin, a professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University and author of 15 books, including Occupy Nation, The Roots, the Spirit, and the Promise of Occupy Wall Street. Find links to Professor Gitlin's articles on the divestment campaign and additional information on the climate change movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.